particularly admirable individual, a local hero, then the greatest and most memorable acts possible would be those undertaken by the spirit, embodied in part by particular individuals, who exemplified what all local heroes everywhere have in common. That hero of heroes, that meta-hero, would have to exist, logically, in turn, in a place that was common across all places, requiring heroism. That place might be regarded as a meta-world, even though it is real, even hyper-real. That is, more real in its abstraction across places than our direct perceptions of a given, singular time or place. It is precisely this hyper-real meta-world that consists of the continual interactions between chaos and order, which eternally serve as the battleground between good and evil characterizing the hero. The undying pattern that hero embodies, in turn, upon whose actions the individual and society both depend, is the highest of all gods. He is both child of and mediator between those twin forces, transforming chaos into habitable order, as well as recasting order into chaos so that it can be renewed when it has become anachronistic and corrupt, as well as battling mightily so that good might prevail. Everyone requires a story to structure their perceptions and actions in what would otherwise be the overwhelming chaos of being. Every story requires a starting place that is not good enough and an ending place that is better. Nothing can be judged in the absence of that end place, that higher value. Without it, everything sinks into meaninglessness and boredom, or degenerates and spirals into terror, anxiety, and pain. But, as time changes all things inexorably, every specific value-predicated story may fail in its particular incarnation and locale and need replacement by something newer, more complete, but different. In consequence, the actor of a given story, and therefore someone deeply affiliated with the plot and the characterization, still must bow to the spirit of creative transformation that originally created and may need to destroy and recreate that story. It is for this reason that spirit eternally transcends dogma, truth transcends presupposition, Marduk transcends the elder gods, creativity updates society, and Christ transcends the law, as does Harry Potter, along with his courageous but continually rule-breaking friends. But it is important to remember, as we discussed in Rule 1, those who break the rules ethically are those who have mastered them first and disciplined themselves to understand the necessity of those rules and break them in keeping with the spirit rather than the letter of the law. The second volume of Rowling's series proposes that predatory evil can be overcome by the soul willing to die and be reborn. The complete series ends with a creatively transformed repetition of the same message. The analogy with Christianity is obvious, and the message, in essence, the same. The soul willing to transform as deeply as necessary is the most effective enemy of the demonic serpents of ideology and totalitarianism in their personal and social forms. The healthy, dynamic, and above all else, truthful personality will admit to error. It will voluntarily shed, let die, outdated perceptions, thoughts, and habits as impediments to its further success and growth. This is the soul that will let its old beliefs burn away, often painfully, so that it can live again and move forward, renewed. This is also the soul that will transmit what it has learned during that process of death and rebirth, so that others can be reborn along with it. Aim at something. Pick the best target you can currently conceptualize. Stumble toward it. Notice your errors and misconceptions along the way. Face them and correct them. Get your story straight. Past, present, future, they all matter. You need to map your path. You need to know where you were so that you do not repeat the mistakes of the past. You need to know where you are, or you will not be able to draw a line from your starting point to your destination. You need to know where you are going, or you will drown in uncertainty, unpredictability, and chaos, and starve for hope and inspiration. for better or worse, you are on a journey. You are having an adventure, and your map better be accurate. Voluntarily confront what stands in your way. The way. That is the path of life, the meaningful path of life, the straight and narrow path that constitutes the very border between order and chaos, and the traversing of which brings them into balance. Aim at something profound and noble and lofty. If you can find a better path along the way, once you have started moving forward, then switch course. Be careful, though. It is not easy to discriminate between changing paths and simply giving up. One hint, if the new path you see forward after learning what you needed to learn along your current way appears more challenging, then you can be reasonably sure that you are not deluding or betraying yourself when you change your mind. In this manner, you will zigzag forward. It is not the most efficient way to travel, but there is no real alternative, given that your goals will inevitably change while you pursue them, as you learn what you need to learn while you are disciplining yourself. You will then find yourself turning across time, incrementally and gracefully, to aim ever more accurately at that tiny pinpoint, the X that marks the spot, the bullseye, and the center of the cross, to aim at the highest value of which you can conceive. You will pursue a target that is both moving and receding. Moving because you do not have the wisdom to aim in the proper direction when you first take aim. Receding because no matter how close you come to perfecting what you are currently practicing, new vistas of possible perfection will open up in front of you. Discipline and transformation will nonetheless lead you inexorably forward. With will and luck, you will find a story that is meaningful and productive, improves itself with time, and perhaps even provides you with more than a few moments of satisfaction and joy. With will and luck, you will be the hero of that story, the disciplined sojourner, the creative transformer, and the benefactor of your family and broader society. Imagine who you could be. And then aim single-mindedly at that. Rule 3. Do not hide unwanted things in the fog. Those damned plates. I love my father-in-law. I respect him, too. He is extremely stable emotionally. One of those tough or fortunate people, perhaps a little of both, who can let the trials and tribulations of life roll off him and keep moving forward with little complaint and plenty of competence. He is an old guy now, Del Roberts, 88. He has had a knee replaced and is planning to get the remaining one done. He has had stents inserted into his coronary arteries and a heart valve replaced. He suffers from drop foot and sometimes slips and falls because of it. But he was still curling a year ago, pushing the heavy granite rock down the ice with a stick specifically designed for people who can no longer crouch down as easily as they once could. When his wife, Beth, now deceased, developed dementia at a relatively young age, he took care of her in as uncomplaining and unresentful a manner as anyone could imagine. It was impressive. I am by no means convinced that I could have fared as well. He cared for her right to the point where it became impossible for him to lift her out of whatever chair she had settled into. This was long after she had lost the ability to speak. But it was obvious by the way her eyes lit up when he entered the room that she still loved him, and the feeling was mutual. I would not describe him as someone who is prone to avoidance when the going gets tough. Quite the contrary. When Dell was a much younger man, he was for several decades a real estate dealer in Fairview, Alberta, the small town where I grew up. We lived right across the street from the Roberts family, in fact. During that time, he habitually went home for lunch, in accordance with the general custom. Beth typically prepared him soup, probably Campbell's, which everyone ate at that time, good, and a sandwich. One day, without warning, he snapped at his wife. Why in the world do we always eat off these tiny plates? I hate eating off these tiny plates. She had been serving the sandwiches on bread and butter plates, which average about 6 or 7 inches in diameter, instead of full-size dinner plates of 10 to 12 inches. She related this story to her daughters soon after in a state of mild shock. This story has been retold to much laughter at family gatherings many times since. After all, she'd been serving him lunch on those plates for at least 20 years by the time he finally said anything. She had no idea that he was annoyed by her table settings. He had never objected. And there's something inexhaustibly amusing about that. Now, it is possible that he was irritated by something else altogether that day and did not really care about the plates. And, in one sense, it is a trivial issue. But seen another way, it is not trivial at all, for two reasons. First, if something happens every day, it is important. And lunch was happening every day. In consequence, if there was something about it that was chronically bothersome, even in a minor sort of way, it needed to be attended to. Second, it is very common to allow so-called minor irritations, which are not minor, as I said, if they happen constantly, to continue for years without comment or resolution. Here is the problem. Collect 100 or 1,000 of those, and your life is miserable and your marriage doomed. Do not pretend you are happy with something if you are not, and if a reasonable solution might, in principle, be negotiated. Have the damn fight. Unpleasant as that might be in the moment, it is one less straw on the camel's back. And that is particularly true for those daily events that everyone is prone to regard as trivial, even the plates on which you eat your lunch. Life is what repeats, and it is worth getting what repeats right. Just not worth the fight. Here is a more serious story of the same type. I had a client who had come to see me about her plans to move to private practice after many years as an accountant with a large corporation. She was well respected in her profession and was a competent, kind, and careful person, but she was also very unhappy. I presumed initially that her unhappiness stemmed from anxiety about her career transition. But she managed that move without a hitch during the time we continued our sessions, while other issues rose to the forefront. Her problem was not her career change. It was her marriage. She described her husband as extraordinarily self-centered and simultaneously overly concerned with how he appeared in the eyes of others. It was a contradictory combination in some manner, although it is common enough to see this touching of opposites in a personality. If you lean too far in one direction, something else in you leans equally far in the other. So, despite the husband's narcissism, at least from his wife's perspective, he was enthralled to the opinions of everyone he met, excepting the members of his own family. He also drank too much, a habit which exaggerated his temperamental defects. My client was not comfortable in her own home. She did not feel there was anything truly of her within the apartment she shared with her husband. The couple had no children. Her situation provided a good example of how what is outside can profoundly reflect what is inside, which is why I suggest to people who are in psychological trouble that they might begin their recovery by cleaning up and then beautifying, if possible, their rooms. All their household furnishings, which she described as showy, ornate, and uncomfortable, had been chosen by her husband. Furthermore, he avidly collected 1960s and 70s pop art, and the walls of the house were crowded with these items, which he had spent time seeking out in galleries and otherwise gathering for many years, often while she sat waiting outside in the car. She told me that she did not care about the furnishings and the excess of decorative objects, but that was not really true. What was true was that she did not care for them, not a bit. Neither the showiness, nor the furnishings, nor the plethora of artworks that made up her husband's collection appealed to her taste. She tended towards a minimalist aesthetic, or perhaps that preference was a consequence of her husband's decorative excesses. It was never quite clear what she might have preferred, and perhaps that was part of the problem. Because she did not know what she liked and was equally vague about her dislikes, she was not in the strongest position to put forward her own opinions. It is difficult to win an argument, or even begin one, if you have not carefully articulated what you want, or do not, and need, or do not. However, she certainly did not enjoy feeling like a stranger in her own home. For that reason, she never had friends over to visit, which was also a non-trivial problem, contributing as it did to her feelings of isolation. But the furnishings and paintings continued to accrue, one shopping expedition at a time, in Canada and abroad, and with each purchase there was less of her in the house and in the marriage, and increasingly more of her husband. Nonetheless, my client never went to war. She never had a fit of anger. She never put her fist through a particularly objectionable canvas hanging on the living room wall. In all the decades of her married life, she never had an outburst of genuine rage. She never directly and conclusively confronted the fact that she hated her home and her subordination to her husband's taste. Instead, she let him have his way, repeatedly, increment by increment, because she claimed that such trivialities were not worth fighting for. And with each defeat, the next disagreement became more necessary, although less likely, because she understood that a serious discussion, once initiated, risked expanding to include all the things that were troublesome about her marriage, and that a real, no-holds-barred battle would therefore likely ensue. Then everything wrong might spill out and have to be faced and dealt with by one means or another. So, she kept silent. But she was chronically repressed and constantly resentful, and felt that she had wasted much of the opportunity of her life. It is a mistake to consider the furnishings and the pop art paintings as simple material objects. They were, more truly and importantly, containers of information, so to speak, about the state of the marriage, and were certainly experienced as such by my client. Every single object of art was the concrete realization of a victory, Pyrrhic though it may have been, and a defeat, or at least a negotiation that did not occur, and, therefore, a fight that was over before it started. And there were dozens or perhaps hundreds of these, each a weapon in an unspoken, destructive, and decades-long war. Unsurprisingly, given the circumstances, the couple split up after 30 years of marriage. I believe the husband retained all the furniture and art. Here is a thought, a terrifying and dispiriting thought, to motivate improvement in your marriage, to scare you into the appalling difficulties of true negotiation. Every little problem you have every morning, afternoon, or evening with your spouse will be repeated for each of the 15,000 days that will make up a 40-year marriage. Every trivial but chronic disagreement about cooking, dishes, house cleaning, responsibility for finances or frequency of intimate contact will be duplicated over and over unless you successfully address it. Perhaps you think, moment to moment at least, that it is best to avoid confrontation and drift along in apparent but false peace. Make no mistake about it, however, you age as you drift, just as rapidly as you age as you strive. But you have no direction when you drift, and the probability that you will obtain what you need and want by drifting aimlessly is very low. Things fall apart of their own accord, but the sins of men speed their deterioration. That is wisdom from the ages. It may well be that conscious apprehension of the horror of the same small hell forever repeated is precisely what is necessary to force you to confront the problems in your marriage and negotiate in good and desperate faith to solve them. However, it is the easiest of matters, particularly in the short term, to ignore the prick of conscience and let the small defeats slide day after day. This is not a good strategy. Only careful aim and wakeful striving and commitment can eliminate the oft-incremental calamity of willful blindness, stem the entropic tide, and keep catastrophe, familial and social alike, at bay. Corruption, commission and omission. Corruption of the form we are discussing is, in my opinion, integrally linked to deception, to lying more bluntly, and, more important, to self-deception. Now, strict logicians regard self-deception as an impossibility. They cannot understand how it is possible for a person to believe one thing and its opposite simultaneously. Logicians are not psychologists, however, and they obviously do not notice, or else fail to take into account, the fact that they themselves have family members, for example, for whom they at least occasionally feel love and hate at the same time. Furthermore, it is not obvious what believe means when discussing human belief, nor what is meant by simultaneously. I can believe one thing today and another tomorrow and very often get away with it, at least in the short term. And on many occasions, I have experienced what was very nearly simultaneous belief in one thing and its opposite while reading undergraduate university papers, in which the writer made a claim in one paragraph and a completely contradictory claim in the next. Sometimes that happened within the span of a single sentence. There are many conditions or circumstances under which self-deception can theoretically occur. Psychoanalysts have explored many of these, with Freud leading the way. Freud believed that much of mental illness was due to repression, which is arguably and reasonably considered a form of self-deception. For him, memories of traumatically troubling events were unconsciously banished to perdition in the unconscious, where they rattled around and caused trouble like poltergeists in a dungeon. Freud understood that the human personality was not unitary. Instead, it consists of a loose, fragmented cacophony of spirits who do not always agree or even communicate. The truth of this claim is self-evident, at least in one simple manner. We can think about things. We can simulate potential or alternative actions or events without immediately having to act them out. Dissociation of thought and action is necessary for abstract thought even to exist. Thus, we can clearly think or say one thing and do another. This is fine when merely thinking prior to acting, but perhaps not so good when we promise or claim to believe something and then act in a manner indicating that we truly have faith in something else. This is a form of deception, a disjunction in character, a contradiction between modes of being. It has even been named to claim one belief and then to act or speak in a different or even opposite manner constitutes a performative contradiction. According to certain modern philosophers, an implicit lie, in my opinion. The holding of contradictory beliefs also becomes a problem when the holder attempts to act out both simultaneously and discovers, often to his or her great chagrin, the paradox that makes such an attempt impossible. Freud cataloged an extensive list of phenomena akin to repression, the act of rejection of potentially conscious psychological material from awareness, which he termed defense mechanisms. These include denial, the truth is not so bad, reaction formation, I really, really, really love my mother, displacement, the boss yells at me, I yell at my wife yells at the baby bites the cat, identification, I am bullied, so I am motivated to be a bully, rationalization, a self-serving explanation for a low-quality action. Intellectualization, a favorite of the early, funny, neurotic Woody Allen. Sublimation, I can always paint nude women. And projection, I'm not touchy, you are just annoying. Freud was an outstanding philosopher of deceit. He was not afraid to point out the relationship between dishonesty and psychopathology. Nonetheless, his ideas of self-deception suffer, in my opinion, from two major errors. First error, Freud failed to notice that sins of omission contributed to mental illness as much as, or more than, the sins of commission listed above that constitute repression. In doing so, he merely thought in the typical manner. People generally believe that actively doing something bad, that is the sin of commission, is, on average, worse than passively not doing something good. That is the sin of omission. Perhaps this is because there are always good things we are not doing, Some sins of omission are therefore inevitable. In any case, there are still times when willful blindness nonetheless produces more serious catastrophes, more easily rationalized away, than the active or the unconscious repression of something terrible but understood, the latter being a sin of commission because it is known. The former problem, willful blindness, occurs when you could come to know something, but cease exploring so that you fail to discover something that might cause you substantial discomfort. Spin doctors call this self-imposed ignorance plausible deniability, which is a phrase that indicates intellectualized rationalization of the most pathological order. It should be noted that such blindness is often regarded as an outright crime. If you are a CEO, for example, and you suspect that your treasurer is cooking the books and you do not investigate because you do not want to know, you may still be liable for your inaction, as is appropriate. Failing to look under the bed when you strongly suspect a monster is lurking there is not an advisable strategy. Second error. Freud assumed that things experienced are things understood. In accordance with that assumption, he believed that a memory trace existed somewhere in the mind that accurately represented the past, like an objective video recording. These would be reasonable presumptions if our experience was simply a series of objectively real and self-evident events transmitted through our senses, thought about, evaluated, and then acted upon. If this was all true, traumatic experience would be accurately represented in memory, even when pushed out of awareness by unconscious mechanisms, or conscious, but Freud presumed the former, because of its understood but terrible nature. However, neither reality nor our processing of reality is as objective or articulated as Freud presupposed. Imagine, for example, that you have been ignored romantically, more than you can tolerate, for several months by your wife or husband. Then you encounter him or her leaning over the fence, talking in a friendly manner, and perhaps no more than that, to an attractive neighbor. How we process such anomalous, novel, troublesome, or even traumatic experience is very rarely a matter of perception, followed by conscious understanding and thought, then emotion or motivation derived from that thought, then action. What happens instead is akin to what we discussed at length in Rule 1 and Rule 2. We process the unknown world from the bottom up. We encounter containers of information, so to speak, whose full import is by no means self-evident. Upon witnessing your spouse talking to the neighbor, therefore, it is not as if you think, in an altogether articulated and fully developed philosophical form, "I have been lonesome and deprived physically for months by my spouse. Although I have not said anything in detail, this has caused me constant frustration and pain. Now he, or she, is rubbing it in, as far as I am concerned, by being so outgoing with a comparative stranger when I have experienced so little attention." It is much more likely that anger, grief, and loneliness have accumulated within you with each rejection, bit by bit, until you are filled to the brim and now overflowing. That sudden appearance of negative emotion does not necessarily mean that you are even now fully conscious of its accumulation. You may well, as in the case of my father-in-law or my client, have experienced the frustration build up gradually enough so that you found yourself more irritable and unhappy, but that does not necessarily mean that you noticed the cause. And what is the cause? The range of possibilities is uncomfortably broad. Perhaps you are not being ignored at all. Instead, you have been having trouble at work, and that has produced a decrease in your overall confidence. In consequence, you have become sensitized to any signs of rejection, even imaginary, within your marriage. So, what you must determine is not so much why your wife or husband is no longer attentive to you, but what it is about your boss, colleagues, or career that is destabilizing you. That puts the true cause of your discomfort a long distance away from the symptoms, the feeling of rejection, that are making you irritable, sensitive, and hurt. There is nothing obvious about the relationship between cause and effect in such cases. Perhaps you really are being ignored, just as you suspect, Perhaps it is a sign of an impending affair and a manifestation of the trajectory that leads to divorce. Both of those, if true, are serious problems. It's no wonder that you're upset. But you may remain stubbornly unwilling to consider that your career or marriage is in trouble. And that is no surprise. But it is not helpful. On top of all that is the general complexity of life, complicating the search for clarity. Consider the question, what really happened? Say, in a failed marriage, divorce, and child custody battle. The answer to that query is so complex that settling the disagreements frequently requires court evaluation and multi-party assessment. Even then, one or even both of the protagonists is unlikely to believe that the truth has been served. This is partly because events in general and interpersonal events specifically do not exist as simple objective facts independent of one another. Everything depends for its meaning, for the information it truly represents, on the context in which it is embedded, much of which is not available for perception or consideration when the event in question occurs. The meaning of what someone's wife says to him today is dependent on everything both have ever said to each other, everything they have ever done together, and the contents of their mutual imaginations. And that does not exhaust the complexity. Such meaning may even be importantly dependent on how, for example, the wife's mother treated her father, or her grandmother treated her grandfather, as well as the relationship between men and women in the broader culture. That is why domestic arguments so often spiral out of control, particularly when a pattern of continual and effective communication has never been established. One thing leads to a deeper thing, and that leads deeper yet, until an argument that started over what size plates are best used at lunchtime turns into a no-holds-barred war about whether the marriage in question would be better dissolved. And there is certainly fear of falling down a hole of that size, again, particularly when much has remained unspoken, that motivates the proclivity to keep things to yourself when they would be better, but dangerously, said. What is the fog? Imagine that you are afraid. You have reason to be. You are afraid of yourself. You are afraid of other people. You are afraid of the world. You are nostalgic for the innocence of the past, for the time before you learned the terrible things that shattered the trust characterizing your childhood. The knowledge you have gained of yourself, other people, and the world has embittered more than enlightened. You have been betrayed, hurt, and disappointed. You have become distrustful even of hope itself, as your hope has been repeatedly shattered, and that is the very definition of hopelessness. The last thing you want is to know more. Better to leave what is enshrouded in mystery. Better as well to avoid thinking too much, or at all, about what could be. When ignorance is bliss, after all, 'tis folly to be wise. Imagine, more precisely, that you are so afraid that you will not allow yourself even to know what you want. Knowing would simultaneously mean hoping, and your hopes have been dashed. You have your reasons for maintaining your ignorance. You are afraid, perhaps, that there is nothing worth wanting. You are afraid that if you specify what you want precisely, you will simultaneously discover, and all too clearly, what constitutes failure. You are afraid that failure is the most likely outcome. And finally, you are afraid that if you define failure and then fail, you will know beyond a shadow of a doubt that it was you that failed and that it was your fault. So, you do not allow yourself to know what you want. You manage this by refusing to think it through. You are happy, satisfied, and engaged sometimes, and unhappy, frustrated, and nihilistic other times, but you will not inquire deeply into why, because then you would know, and then you would encounter yet again shattered hope and confirmed disappointment. You are also afraid, but for different reasons, to allow others to know what you want. First, if they were to find out just what you wanted, then they might tell you, and then you would know, even if you were fighting against gathering that very knowledge. Second, if they knew, they could then deny you what you truly wanted, even needed, and hurt you much more efficiently than they might if your deepest desires, and therefore your vulnerabilities, remained secret. The fog that hides is the refusal to notice, to attend to, emotions and motivational states as they arise, and the refusal to communicate them both to yourself and to the people who are close to you. A bad mood signifies something. A state of anxiety or sadness signifies something, and not likely something that will please you to discover. The most probable outcome of successfully articulating an emotion that has accrued without expression over time is tears, an admission of vulnerability and pain, which are also feelings that people do not like to allow, particularly when they are feeling distrustful and angry. Who wants to dig down into the depths of pain and grief and guilt until the tears emerge? And voluntary refusal to take notice of our emotional states is not the only impediment to dealing with them. If your wife or husband or whomever else you are tangled up with unhappily at the moment says something that comes too close to the painful truth, for example, then a sharp and insulting remark will often shut them up and is therefore very likely to be offered. This is partly a test. Does the person being insulted care enough about you and your suffering to dig past a few obstacles and unearth the bitter truth? It is also partly and more obviously defensive. If you can chase someone away from something you yourself do not want to discover, that makes your life easier in the present. Sadly, it is also very disappointing if that defense succeeds and is typically accompanied by a sense of abandonment, loneliness, and self-betrayal. You must nonetheless still live among other people and they with you. And you have desires, wants, and needs, however unstated and unclear. And you are still motivated to pursue them, not least because it is impossible to live without desire, want, and need. Your strategy under such conditions? Show your disappointment whenever someone close to you makes you unhappy. Allow yourself the luxury and pleasure of resentment when something does not go your way. Ensure that the person who has transgressed against you is frozen out by your disapproval. Force them to discover with as much difficulty as possible exactly what they have done to disappoint you. And finally, let them grope around blindly in the fog that you have generated around yourself until they stumble into and injure themselves on the sharp, hidden edges of your unrevealed preferences and dreams. And maybe these responses are tests too, tests deeply associated with the lack of courage to trust. If you really loved me, you would brave the terrible landscape that I have arrayed around myself to discover the real me. And perhaps there is even something to such claims, implicit though they may be. A certain testing of commitment might have its utility. Everything does not have to be given away for free. But even a little unnecessary mystery goes a long way. And you still must live with yourself. In the short term, perhaps you are protected from the revelation of your insufficiency by your refusal to make yourself clear. Every ideal is a judge, after all, the judge who says, you are not manifesting your true potential. No ideals? No judge. But the price paid for that is purposelessness. This is a high price. No purpose? Then, no positive emotion. As most of what drives us forward with hope intact is the experience of approaching something we deeply need and want. And worse, when we are without purpose. Chronic, overwhelming anxiety, as focused purpose constrains what is otherwise likely to be the intolerable chaos of unexploited possibility and too much choice. If you make what you want clear and commit yourself to its pursuit, you may fail. But if you do not make what you want clear, then you will certainly fail. You cannot hit a target that you refuse to see. You cannot hit a target if you do not take aim. And, equally dangerously in both cases, you will not accrue the advantage of aiming, but missing. You will not benefit from the learning that inevitably takes place when things do not go your way. Success at a given endeavor often means trying, falling short, recalibrating, with the new knowledge generated painfully by the failure, and then trying again and falling short, often repeated, ad nauseam. Sometimes all that learning, impossible without the failure, leads you to see that aiming your ambition in a different direction would be better, not because it is easier, not because you have given up, not because you are avoiding, but because you have learned through the vicissitudes of your experience that what you seek is not to be found where you were looking, or is simply not attainable in the manner by which you chose to pursue it. So, what might you do? What should you do as an alternative to hiding things in the fog? Admit to your feelings. This is a very tricky matter, and it does not simply mean give in to them. First, noting, much less communicating, feelings of petty anger or pain due to lonesomeness or anxiety about something that might be trivial or jealousy that is likely unwarranted is embarrassing. The admission of such feelings is a revelation of ignorance, insufficiency, and vulnerability. Second, it is unsettling to allow for the possibility that your feelings, however overwhelming and convincing, might be misplaced and, in your ignorance, pointing you in the wrong direction. It is possible that you have misinterpreted the situation entirely for reasons of which you remain fundamentally unconscious. It is for such reasons that trust is vital, but trust of the mature and tragic sort. A naive person trusts because he or she believes that people are essentially or even universally trustworthy. But any person who has truly lived has been or has betrayed. Someone with experience knows that people are capable of deception and willing to deceive. That knowledge brings with it an arguably justified pessimism about human nature, personal and otherwise. But it also opens the door to another kind of faith in humanity, one based on courage rather than naivete. I will trust you. I will extend my hand to you, despite the risk of betrayal, because it is possible, through trust, to bring out the best in you, and perhaps in me. So I will accept substantial risk to open the door to cooperation and negotiation. And even if you do betray me, in a not too unforgivable manner, assuming a certain degree, shall we say, of genuine apology and contrition on your part, I will continue to extend my hand. And part of the way I will do that is by telling you what I am feeling. A certain necessary humility must accompany such raw revelations. I should not say, at least not ideally, you have been ignoring me lately. I should say, instead, I feel isolated and lonely and hurt and cannot help but feel that you have not been as attentive to me over the last few months as I would have liked or that might have been best for us as a couple. But I am unsure if I am just imagining all this because I am upset or if I am genuinely seeing what is going on. The latter statement gets the point across but avoids the accusatory stance that so often serves as the first defense against a serious get-to-the-bottom-of-things conversation. And it is very possible that you are wrong about just what is causing you to feel the way you do. If you are, you need to know it, because there is no point in propagating errors that are causing you and others pain and interfering with your future. Best to find out what is true. Best to disperse the fog and find out if the sharp objects you feared were lurking there are real or fantastical. And there is always the danger that some of them are real. But it is better to see them than to keep them occluded by the fog, because you can at least sometimes avoid the danger that you are willing to see. Events and memories. Events, as they lay themselves out in front of us, do not simply inform us of why they occur, and we do not remember the past in order to objectively record bounded, well-defined events and situations. The latter act is impossible in any case. The information in our experience is latent, like gold in ore, the case we made in Rule 2. It must be extracted and refined with great effort, and often in collaboration with other people, before it can be employed to improve the present and the future. We use our past effectively when it helps us repeat desirable and avoid repeating undesirable experiences. We want to know what happened, but more importantly, we want to know why. Why is wisdom. Why enables us to avoid making the same mistake again and again, and if we are fortunate, helps us repeat our successes. Extracting useful information from experience is difficult. It requires the purest of motivations, and the belief that things should be made better, not worse, to perform it properly. It requires the willingness to confront error forthrightly and to determine at what point and why departure from the proper path occurred. It requires the willingness to change, which is almost always indistinguishable from the decision to leave something, or someone, or some idea, behind. Therefore, the simplest response imaginable is to look away and refuse to think, while simultaneously erecting insurmountable impediments to genuine communication. Unfortunately, in the longer term, this willful blindness leaves life murky and foggy, leaves it void, unseen, without form, confused, and leaves you bewildered and astonished. This is all a strange concatenation of the psychological and the real, the subjective and the objective. Is something frightening? Or am I afraid? Is something beautiful? Or am I imposing the idea of beauty upon it? When I become angry with someone, is it because of something they have done? Or my lack of control? Such questions define the state of confusion you occupy chronically when the bottom has fallen out of your world. That state can have an objective element, because a fall is often caused by something real, such as a death, a serious illness, or a bout of unemployment, but it is also subjective, associated with a state composed of pain, doubt, confusion, and the inability to choose or even perceive a path forward. The ground of being is subject and object simultaneously, motivation, emotion, and material thing all at once, before perception is clarified, before the world is articulated. The wife remains uncomprehended. The context of her speech remains unexplored for fear of what that exploration might reveal. The situation cannot be described because the word is left vague and unformed. Our own personal motivations begin in hidden form and remain that way because we do not want to know what we are up to. The wheat remains unseparated from the chaff. The gold remains in the clutches of the dragon, as does the virgin. The philosopher's stone remains undiscovered in the gutter, and the information hidden in the round chaos, beckoning, remains unexplored. Such omission is the voluntary refusal of expanded consciousness. After all, the pathway to the Holy Grail has its beginnings in the darkest part of the forest, and what you need remains hidden where you least want to look. If you pile up enough junk in your closet, one day, when you are least prepared, the door will spring open, and all of what has been packed inside, growing inexorably in the darkness, will bury you, and you may not have enough time or energy left in your life to confront it, sort through it, keep what you need, and discard the rest. This is what it means to be crushed under excess baggage. This is the return of Tiamat, the great Mesopotamian goddess of chaos, destroyer of those who act improperly. The world is full of hidden dangers and obstacles, and opportunities. Leaving everything hidden in the fog because you are afraid of the dangers you may find there will be of little help when fate forces you to run headlong toward what you have refused to see. Impaling yourself on sharp branches, stumbling over boulders, and rushing by places of sanctuary, you will finally refuse to admit you could have burned away the haze with the bright light of your consciousness had you not hidden it under a bushel. Then you will come to curse man, reality, and God himself for producing such an impenetrable maze of impediments and barriers. Corruption will beckon to you, led as you increasingly will be by dark, unexamined motivations, bred by failure, amplified by frustration, viciously culminating in the resentful belief that those who have transgressed against you are getting from you exactly what they deserve. This attitude and the actions and inactions it will inevitably produce will impoverish your life, your community, your nation, and the world. This will in turn impoverish being itself, and that will be exactly what your darkest unexamined motivations desire. With careful searching, with careful attention, you might tip the balance toward opportunity and against obstacle sufficiently so that life is clearly worth living despite its fragility and suffering. If you truly wanted, perhaps you would receive if you asked. If you truly sought, perhaps you would find what you seek. If you knocked, truly wanting to enter. perhaps the door would open. But there will be times in your life when it will take everything you have to face what is in front of you, instead of hiding away from a truth so terrible that the only thing worse is the falsehood you long to replace it with. Do not hide unwanted things in the fog. Rule 4. Notice that opportunity lurks where responsibility has been abdicated. Make yourself invaluable. In my dual role as clinical psychologist and professor, I have coached many people in the development of their careers. Sometimes those I am coaching consult me because their coworkers, subordinates, or bosses will not do their jobs properly. They are supervised by, working alongside, or managing people who are narcissistic, incompetent, malevolent, or tyrannical. Such things happen and must be dealt with in whatever reasonable manner will bring them to a halt. I do not encourage people to martyr themselves. It is a bad idea to sacrifice yourself uncomplainingly so that someone else can take the credit. Nonetheless, under such circumstances, if you are a wise and attentive person, you might still notice that your unproductive co-workers are leaving a plethora of valuable tasks undone. You might then ask yourself, what would happen if I took responsibility for doing them? It is a daunting question. What is left undone is often risky, difficult, and necessary. But that also means, does it not, that it is worthwhile and significant? And you may have the eyes to see that there is a problem, despite your all-too-frequent blindness. How do you know that it is not, therefore, your problem? Why do you notice this issue and not some other? This is a question worth considering in depth. If you want to become invaluable in a workplace, in any community, just do the useful things no one else is doing. Arrive earlier and leave later than your compatriots. But do not deny yourself your life. Organize what you can see is dangerously disorganized. Work when you are working, instead of looking like you are working. And finally, learn more about the business or your competitors than you already know. Doing so will make you invaluable, a veritable linchpin. People will notice that and begin to appreciate your hard-earned merits. You might object, "Well, I just could not manage to take on something that important." What if you began to build yourself into a person who could? You could start by trying to solve a small problem, something that is bothering you that you think you could fix. You could start by confronting a dragon of just the size that you are likely to defeat. A tiny serpent might not have had the time to hoard a lot of gold, but there might still be some treasure to be won, along with a reasonable probability of succeeding in such a quest and not too much chance of a fiery or toothsome death. Under reasonable circumstances, picking up the excess responsibility is an opportunity to become truly invaluable. And then, if you want to negotiate for a raise, or more autonomy, or more free time, for that matter, you can go to your boss and say, "Here are 10 things that were crying out to be done, each of them vital, and I am now doing all of them. If you help me out a bit, I will continue. I might even improve, and everything, including your life, will improve along with me." And then, if your boss has any sense, and sometimes bosses do, then your negotiation will be successful. That is how such things work. And do not forget that there is no shortage of genuinely good people who are thrilled if they can give someone useful and trustworthy a hand up. It is one of the truly altruistic pleasures of life, and its depth is not to be underestimated or to be disregarded with the cheap cynicism that masks itself as world-weary wisdom. It appears that the meaning that most effectively sustains life is to be found in the adoption of responsibility. When people look back on what they have accomplished, they think, if they are fortunate, "Well, I did that, and it was valuable. It was not easy, but it was worth it." It is a strange and paradoxical fact that there is a reciprocal relationship between the worth of something and the difficulty of accomplishing it. Imagine the following conversation. Do you want difficulty? "No, I want ease." In your experience, has doing something easy been worthwhile? "Well, no, not very often." "Then perhaps you really want something difficult." I think that is the secret to the reason for being itself. Difficult is necessary. It is for this reason that we voluntarily and happily place limitations on ourselves. Every time we play a game, for example, we accept a set of arbitrary restrictions. We narrow and limit ourselves and explore the possibilities thereby revealed. That is what makes the game. But it does not work without the arbitrary rules. You take them on voluntarily, absurdly, as in chess. I can only move this knight in an L. How ridiculous! But how fun! Because it is not fun, oddly enough, if you can move any piece anywhere. It is not a game anymore if you can make any old move at all. Accept some limitations, however, and the game begins. Accept them, more broadly speaking, as a necessary part of being and a desirable part of life. Assume you can transcend them by accepting them. And then you can play the limited game properly. And this is all not merely of psychological import. And it is by no means just a game. People need meaning, but problems also need solving. It is very salutary from the psychological perspective to find something of significance, something worth sacrificing for or to, something worth confronting and taking on. But the suffering and malevolence that characterize life are real, with the terrible consequences of the real, and our ability to solve problems by confronting them and taking them on is also real. By taking responsibility, we can find a meaningful path, improve our personal lot psychologically, and make what is intolerably wrong genuinely better. Thus, we can have our cake and eat it, too. Responsibility and meaning. The idea that life is suffering is a relatively universal truism of religious thinking. This is the first of the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism, as well as a key Hindu concept. There is a tradition that the ancient Indian word for suffering, dukkha from the Pali language, or dukkha from Sanskrit, is derived from dus, bad, and ka, hole, particularly the hole in a horse-drawn cartwheel through which the axle passes. The proper place for such a hole is dead center, right on target. The ride is likely to be very bumpy otherwise, with the bumps directly proportional in magnitude to the degree of offset. This is quite reminiscent, to me, of the Greek term hamartia, which is frequently translated as sin in the context of Christian thought. Hamartia was originally an archery term, and it meant to miss the mark or target. There are many ways that a target can be missed. Frequently, in my clinical practice and in my personal life, I observed that people did not get what they needed, or, equally importantly, perhaps, what they wanted, because they never made it clear to themselves or others what that was. It is impossible to hit a target, after all, unless you aim at it. In keeping with this, people are more commonly upset by what they did not even try to do than by the errors they actively committed while engaging with the world. At least, if you misstep while doing something, you can learn from doing it wrong. But to remain passive in the face of life, even if you excuse your inaction as a means of avoiding error, that is a major mistake. As the great blues musician Tom Waits insists in his song A Little Rain, you must risk something that matters. This is the colossal blunder made, for example, by the fictional Peter Pan. Pan, a name echoing the Greek god of the wilds, means encompassing everything. Peter Pan, the magical boy, is capable of everything. He is potential itself, like every child, and that makes him magical, in the same way that every child is magical. But time whittles that magic away, transforming the fascinating potentiality of childhood into the oft apparently more mundane but genuine actuality of adulthood. The trick, so to speak, is to trade that early possibility for something meaningful, productive, long-term, and sustainable. Peter Pan refuses to do so. This is at least in part because his major role model is Captain Hook. Captain Hook is the archetypal tyrannical king, the pathology of order, a parasite and a tyrant, terrified of death. He has his reasons. Death stalks Hook in the form of a crocodile with a clock in his stomach. That is time. Tick-tock, tick-tock. That is life vanishing as the seconds march by. The crocodile has had a taste of Hook, too, and liked it. That is life as well. It is not only cowards who are terrified by what lurks down in the chaotic depths. It is a rare person who has not suffered through disappointment, disease, and the death of a loved one by the time childhood ends. Such experiences can leave those who have had them bitter, resentful, predatory, and tyrannical, just like Hook. With a role model like the captain, it is no wonder Peter Pan does not want to grow up. Better to remain lost in fantasy with Tinkerbell, who provides everything a female partner can provide, except that she does not exist. Wendy, the great love of Pan's life, chooses to grow up despite her admiration for her friend Peter. She takes a husband, facing, even welcoming her maturation and its lurking hints of mortality and death. She consciously chooses to sacrifice her childhood for the realities of adulthood, but gains real life in return. Peter remains a child, magical to be sure, but still a child, and life, limited, finite, and unique, passes him by. In the J.M. Barrie play, Peter Pan or the Boy Who Would Not Grow Up, Pan is portrayed as unafraid of death, which he faces on Marooner's Rock. His attitude might be misunderstood by inattentive viewers as courage. After all, Pan says, "To die will be an awfully big adventure." But the psychologically insightful unseen narrator objects, "To live would be an awfully big adventure." Truly a statement about what might have happened had the boy king chosen Wendy, noting immediately afterward, but he can never quite get the hang of it. Pan's hypothetical lack of fear of death is not courage, but the manifestation of his basically suicidal nature, the sickness of life, which he is constantly manifesting by his very refusal to mature. It is by no means a good thing to be the oldest person at the frat party. It is desperation masquerading as cool rebelliousness, and there's a touchy despondence and arrogance that goes along with it. It smacks of Neverland. In the same manner, the attractive potential of a directionless but talented 25-year-old starts to look hopeless and pathetic at 30 and downright past its expiration date at 40. You must sacrifice something of your manifold potential in exchange for something real in life. Aim at something. Discipline yourself, or suffer the consequence. And what is that consequence? All the suffering of life, with none of the meaning. Is there a better description of hell? Life is dukkha for the Buddhists, equally, perhaps, although less explicitly, for the Hindus. The Hebrew scriptures, for their part, chronicle the history of the suffering of the Jewish people, individually and as a nation, although the triumphs are not ignored. Even those who are called on by Yahweh himself to move into the adventure of life by no means escape catastrophe. Perhaps Abraham, the archetypal patriarch, had an intuition of this. He was clearly something of a Peter Pan himself. The biblical account insists that Abraham stayed safely ensconced within his father's tent until he was 75 years old, a late start, even by today's standards. Then, called by God, inspired by the voice within, let us say, to leave family and country, he journeys forward into life. And what does he encounter after heeding the divine call to adventure? First, famine, then tyranny in Egypt, the potential loss of his beautiful wife to more powerful men, exile from his adopted country, conflicts over territory with his kinsmen, war and the kidnapping of his nephew, extended childlessness despite God's promise to make him the progenitor of a great nation, and, finally, terrible conflict between his spouses. The Abrahamic story made a great impact on me when I began to study and appreciate it more deeply. It has at its core a strange combination of pessimism and realistic, genuine encouragement. The pessimism? Even if you are called by God himself to venture out into the world, as Abraham was, life is going to be exceptionally difficult. even under the best of all conceivable circumstances, almost insuperable obstacles will emerge and obstruct your path. The encouragement? You will have the opportunity to reveal yourself as much stronger and more competent than you might imagine. There is a potential within you, some of that magic so evident in childhood, that will emerge when circumstances demand and transform you, God willing, into someone who can prevail. There is a very old idea, which I have only recently come to comprehend, at least in part. It is something you see manifested in many literary, imagistic, and dramatic forms, ancient and modern. It has to do with responsibility and meaning, but its true significance appears hidden in precisely the same way that the wisdom dreams can bring forth is so often hidden. It is associated with the labyrinthine myth of the hero, he who speaks magic words, sees what others cannot or refuse to see, overcomes the giant, leads his people, slays the dragon, finds the treasure hard to attain, and rescues the virgin. These are all variants of the same perceptual and behavioral pattern, which is an outline of the universally adaptive pattern of being. The hero is also he who rescues his father from the belly of the beast. What could this idea